Hi, I'm Tess Vegland. How'd you like to be on the ground floor of a stock headed straight up? Yeah, me too. But beware the IPO mutual fund.
It's like a lot of things. It looks easy and looks simple, and it isn't.
We have the ABCs of IPOs. Plus, experts are careful when they talk about the economy from their public podiums. Those who comment from the couch with a laptop can be a bit more candid.
My favorite analogy is like a James Bond movie where your plane just crashed and sliding towards a cliff, and you don't know if you're going to fall over the cliff or you're just going to teeter on the edge.
Our personal finance bloggers sound off. And for many of us, our job is who we are. Author Alain de Botton says that concept's pretty new.
Work was something that people did, but it wasn't where they expected to put their center of meaning and their hope for a good life.
Hear his ideas on the pleasures and sorrows of work. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. Sure, you'd like to make some money off your money. Not many places to do that these days. That's why some investors are dipping their toes back into stocks. But really, should we be getting anywhere near an IPO? I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com.
Perhaps you've been asking yourself recently, whatever happened to the IPO? Okay, perhaps you haven't. But certainly you remember the days when initial public offerings made scads of people scads of money. IPOs were always risky. And in these risk-averse days, instead of going public, they went silent. But the tide may be turning. This week, Fidelity Investments, the nation's largest mutual fund company, announced it'll offer its customers exclusive access to IPOs from a private equity firm. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson looked into whether this is a good idea for anybody.
Kohlberg Kravis Roberts & Company, or KKR for short, owns dozens of companies, but it hasn't taken one public in 3 years, which means its own money is tied up and can't be invested in new companies. Bruce Furster is president of South Beach Capital Markets. He says with the Fidelity deal, KKR gets access to new investors so it can free its own cash.
KKR is attempting, among other things, to recapture fees, and I would suspect trying to get more control over their own destiny.
As for Fidelity, he says, the mutual fund company is looking to take advantage of a changing landscape on Wall Street, perhaps capture some of the wealthy clients fleeing big-name firms like Merrill Lynch and UBS, the kind of people who are intrigued by talk of IPOs.
Wall Street views the IPO product as proprietary product.
In other words, you have to be in a club to get access, and Fidelity now has the secret password, at least for its more sophisticated clients who have more than $100,000 invested. But even if you fit that description, Furster says, you shouldn't necessarily be jumping on the IPO bandwagon.
It's like a lot of things. It looks easy and looks simple, and it isn't.
In order to be investing that way, you really need to do two things.
Marian Asnes is the editor of Financial Planning magazine.
One is know a tremendous amount about the company and its prospects, and it's how it's managed. How is it making its money? The second thing you need to know is that you can afford to lose the money because things go wrong as well as right.
Just ask investors who took advantage of the IPO boom that fueled the tech bubble and threw money into Pets.com. The website barked onto the scene in 1998 and went the way of old Yeller in 2000. But Fidelity isn't offering access to IPOs to long-term investors with just a mutual fund or a 401k.
It's for institutions, it's for wealth managers, and it's for wealthier clients.
The importance of Fidelity's move for the rest of us, Bruce Furster says, is indirect. The company is positioning itself in case of an IPO boom.
If the IPO market starts to heat up again, the word gets out very quickly, within minutes, seconds, and Fidelity's big clients, individual clients, are going to push on Fidelity's brokers and say, hey, I want some of that product.
And if that product is fruitful, Furster says, it could mean a lot of jobs for a lot of people. That, he says, is what IPOs do best, raise money for companies to grow.
I see it as a national asset. It's an integral part of the great American job creation machine.
Even if, on the investing side, it kind of resembles a slot machine. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace Money.
So if you did have a chance to get in on a company's ground floor, which one would it be? Well, I certainly wish, having grown up in the Pacific Northwest, that I'd gotten a piece of Nike, Starbucks, Nordstrom, maybe a little Microsoft. Oh, well. We sent producer Stephen Hoffman out on the streets of Los Angeles to ask a few people what would be on their wish list.
Well, I would have invested in Google.
Probably Google or Microsoft, something like that.
Walmart. A lot of money.
I'm wondering about the car companies at this point in time, like GM and Chrysler.
Google.
Google, because they skyrocketed the most. Walmart.
Microsoft, because I know that it's been incredibly successful, and I know retrospectively that it's done very well, and it's something that I use every single day.
Mine would be Apple.
Well, logic would say Google, but right now I would say Campbell's Soup because Campbell's Soup is exploding because of the recession.
Starbucks, because they're everywhere.
That's for sure. Let us know which companies you wish you'd taken a risk on. Write to us at marketplace.org.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thriven.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. And now we turn to mutual funds of another sort, the kind that used to be the opposite of risky. Vanguard made some significant changes to three of its money market mutual funds in an effort to preserve some sort of return for investors. Here to help explain is John Wagoner. He writes a column on mutual funds for USA Today. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Money market mutual funds have been in the news quite a bit over the last few months because last fall, one of the big ones did what's called breaking the buck. And this is not something that's supposed to happen with money market mutual funds. Remind us again what happened.
Sure. Breaking the buck is what they refer to technically as a really bad thing. money funds are supposed to keep their share prices at $1 per share each day, every day. So it gives you the feeling that your share price won't go up and down like it would, like, say, with a stock fund.
Right. You put a dollar in and you're definitely going to get a dollar back.
Right. Except, of course, when you don't, which is what happened with the reserve fund.
Right. So they broke the buck.
Yes, they did.
Now, with that as background, now we are looking at the possibility of some of these money market mutual funds breaking the buck through really no fault of their own. Explain to us how this is happening.
Well, the problem is that interest rates are so low that many funds are having to eat their expenses. It costs some money to run a money market fund, and the funds take, you know, a certain amount of cash off the top to run the fund. Right now, the average money fund is yielding 0.17%, which is next to nothing. The problem is some funds may not be able to, you know, continue eating those expenses.
But basically what the consumer is facing is that they've got such a low interest rate in the first place, and then you add on to that any fees that are imposed by the mutual fund company, even if they're, you know, famous for being low, like Vanguard, and all of a sudden you're at less than zero.
Well, that's right. Technically, unless the funds, you know, add this extra money in or stop taking money for expenses, there is the danger that they could break a buck. Low rates also present some other dangers, though, that are probably more likely for a lot of funds. Most funds would probably liquidate the fund before they had to break a buck to take their own expenses.
So if you're a consumer looking at the money market mutual fund, is this still a viable place to put your money?
Well, for most people, if all you want is just a short-term parking place, it's okay. Most of the large funds are really self-insured, as it were. They'll step up to the plate and replace things. What you do kind of worry about are the smaller funds, which, rather than close down, might consider doing something silly to increase their yield, like buy things that are much longer term or buy things that are much lower quality. Those are two ways you can kind of goose up your yield, but both increase your risk.
So is that an argument for going with a larger mutual fund company?
It's an argument for going for a larger mutual fund company, and it's also an argument to just be wary of funds that seem to have relatively high yields. If the average fund is getting 0.17% and you see somebody who's offering 0.5%, you have to say, golly, how are they doing that anyway?
At this point, aren't you going to get a better return even if you just go with like a high-yield online savings account?
Absolutely. You'll not only get a higher return, but you'll get FDIC insurance for the full amount, up to $250,000. So yeah, if you're looking for just rock-solid safety, banks are the place to be.
And isn't that what money market mutual funds used to be?
Oh, once upon a time, yes, they were.
Boy, once upon a time, that seems to sum up the entire financial crisis, doesn't it?
Oh, it sure does. And you never know what surprises still lay in store for us.
John Wagner is the mutual fund columnist for USA Today. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Last week, economist Peter Bernstein died at the age of 90. Chances are, unless you're what we affectionately like to call an economics geek, you've never heard of him. So we turn, affectionately, to our own geek, Chris Farrell, for an appreciation of how Bernstein influenced our financial lives.
You can't beat the market. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. Worry about risk. I like to think of these as my marketplace money mantras. They seem like common sense ideas now, but several decades ago, professional investors laughed at them. They were insights dreamed up by ivory tower eggheads far from Wall Street who'd put together complicated formulas and equations to prove their points. Get real, said the Wall Street veterans. This is nonsense. We can beat the market. The academics got the last laugh. The real-world evidence is overwhelming that the pros routinely do worse than the market. For instance, 2/3 of actively managed mutual funds underperform the major market indexes year in and year out. The eggheads also came up with some better investing products, like the Equity Index Fund. When you and I put our money into an index fund, we match the market and beat the pros. All this thanks to Peter Bernstein. His real triumph was to translate the equations of modern finance into eloquent English. A generation of journalists and portfolio managers learned from his writings. Bernstein's biggest contribution, though, was in thinking about risk. Wall Street loves to use complex mathematical models to talk about and minimize the downside. Bernstein preferred to emphasize the financial dangers we face with easily understood examples drawn from Hamlet and G.K. Chesterton. His perspective? The key question when it comes to managing your money is this. What is the downside? What could go wrong? And if the unthinkable happens, like a credit crunch, a recession, and a bear market, can you weather the storm? It's simple but profound. That's why I'm always talking about diversifying, hedging, and saving. This way, the consequences of being wrong may be financially painful, but never catastrophic. Bernstein was the financial market's leading philosopher of risk. He also made finance theory fun.
It's not often you walk into a government office and get more help than you thought you had coming to you.
According to them, I could possibly be eligible for some food stamps, which would help me quite a bit.
We'll hear from an outreach program that matches people in need with benefits they didn't know they could get. It's up next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Thank you.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. We all like to think we're getting everything we can for our tax dollars. But that assumes we know everything that's available to us. And apparently, we don't. Americans fail to claim $39 billion worth of government benefits every year. That's everything from food stamps to funding for home improvements. A program called the Benefit Bank is now helping connect people in six states with those benefits. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler went to Ohio to check it out.
The van parks outside a retirement home in Circleville, a small town in central Ohio. With the flick of a switch, a generator comes on. It powers printers and computers with internet access in this office on wheels. The van is a mobile extension of the Benefit Bank, a program that matches people with services, things like health care, food stamps, and home energy assistance. William Stickle, an unemployed construction worker in his 40s, takes a seat in the van across from counselor Aaron Sprouse.
Okay, so when did you start receiving unemployment?
In February.
Stickle has come to the Benefit Bank to see if he's entitled to services that he may not know about. Any assistance would help.
We just don't make enough money to feed everybody and take care of the payments on the house.
The Stickles have three sons. His wife works as a hospital administrator. But that income isn't enough to cover the $1,000 mortgage payment and a food bill that can run as much as $200 a week.
The six-year-old eats about every 15 minutes.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Stickle applied for food stamps right after he was laid off, but he was told that he made too much money to qualify. Benefit Bank counselor Aaron Sprouse says many people apply too early.
What they do is they take your last 30 days of income. So if you were just employed last week, then it looks like you're making more money. But once you're actually unemployed, lose that income, your eligibility changes.
She also helped Stickle fill out applications for assistance with the heating bill and home weatherization. Each year, in Ohio alone, $1.5 billion in benefits goes unclaimed. Food stamps and children's health insurance are two of the most overlooked benefits, and many families also miss out on tax credits. A typical low-income family with kids that uses the Benefit Bank often gets about $15,000 worth of tax credits and untapped services.
To date, we have helped low- and moderate-income Ohioans secure over $100 million in public benefits and work support programs that help them meet their basic needs and weather the storm.
That's Lisa Hamler-Fugit, executive director of the Ohio Association of Second Harvest Food Banks, which manages and operates the Benefit Bank. She says the system for public benefits is fragmented and confusing.
For the new poor, they're very embarrassed. They don't want to be seen at the local welfare office.
Hamler-Fugit says people are more comfortable visiting one of the 800 Benefit Bank sites set up around the state in community centers and churches. Outside the Benefit Bank van, I spoke with 70-year-old Bonnie Frazier.
Why did you come here today?
Just to see if there was anything available that I didn't already know about.
Did you learn anything?
Yes, I did. According to them, I could possibly be eligible for some food stamps, which would help me quite a bit.
She lives on a fixed income of less than $1,000 a month. Food stamps would give her another $150 a month for groceries.
And our 800 number's on the back, so if you give us a call, we can find a site in your area.
The Benefit Bank helps people with more than identifying financial assistance. At another event in Columbus, Sibley Arnebeck came away with a job referral.
I am 64 and just lost my job, and I'm looking for at least some part-time work.
Okay.
And they have a resource that I can sign up with, and they could match me, they say, for 20 hours a week employment.
The Benefit Bank seems to be a hit with the people who use it and its funders. Lisa Cordes is with the Columbus Foundation, which helped launch the program and paid for the van.
The Benefit Bank has just been one of the best investments we've made in our 63-year history.
It's an investment that also pays off for the state. Lisa Hamler-Fugit says most of the benefits are paid for with federal dollars, but that money is spent in local communities.
Then it starts the economic driver of job creation where those benefits are redeemed locally. It means people are being hired to work in those grocery stores. People are working in those hospitals or those clinics.
Ohio's program has served about 60,000 people. It's considered a model for the country. Five other states are considering setting up their own benefit banks. In Columbus, Ohio, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
Every once in a while, we check in with three bloggers from the world of personal finance, and it is time for yet another visit. Steve blogs at BritBlap.com, and Lene is at BeingFrugal.net, and you will find Jim at Bargaineering.com. We all first chatted about a year ago, and what a year it has been. So, we kicked off with Jim and his view of how things look now.
My favorite analogy is like a James Bond movie where your plane just crashed and sliding towards a cliff. And you don't know if you're going to fall over the cliff or you're just going to teeter on the edge. And in the last few months, it seems like we're going to teeter but not go over. And everyone's becoming a little more confident and a little less scared. And I think that's great news.
Lene, would you agree with that assessment?
Yeah, I would definitely agree. I think a year ago, people were starting to get really panicked. Commenters on my blog, you could tell they were really concerned. And now it's almost like they don't really want to talk about the economy so much anymore just because they are getting a little bit more confident and they don't want to talk about the doom and gloom anymore. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I suppose there's maybe a little doom and gloom exhaustion at this point. Steve, what about you? What are you seeing and thinking?
Well, I think what Lene and Jim said was absolutely dead on, that a lot of people had panicked at about this point last year. And at this point, a lot of people have started saying, oh, we see the signs pointing in the right direction. Everything's going to be okay. Maybe they're a little bit too optimistic, but I think that we are headed in the right direction.
I want to talk to all of you a little bit about the topic of debt. Because I think all of you have written about it in one form or another. Steve, I want to get your take on the debt and particularly the credit card issue, because you have written recently about being a bit tired of the demonization of the credit card industry, particularly as the most recent legislation was being debated and passed. You compare credit cards to a shovel that can be used for good or ill. Give us your perspective on this particular debate.
I think the analogy I used was you can use a shovel to dig a hole and plant a garden, or you can use it to hit somebody over the back of the head and kill them. There were a lot of arguments made when I started writing about this. The credit card companies are profiting, whether you pay off your balance in full each month or not, whether you carry balance or not. But the way I look at it is that using or misusing their tool is an individual responsibility at the end of the day.
I think a lot of people miss the fact that you voluntarily apply for a credit card.
Right.
And a lot of people make it out to be that the credit cards, yes, at times they may be taking advantage of the situation, but you yourself put yourself in that situation.
And I'll add, too, there's no doubt that they use every marketing trick in the book. But again, there's a lot of products out there that people use that you have to be very careful using.
Lene, how do you feel about debt?
I don't like it. I mean, I do have a mortgage. I do have some student loan debt. I always try to not go into debt if I can do things that way. We've opted not to go with credit cards. We don't have any credit cards right now. So any vacations, any purchasing that we do is done on a cash basis, which works really well for us. At the same time, you can't buy a house these days. Most people can't buy a house these days without a mortgage. And so, you know, we took one out when we bought our house, and I'm okay with that. I think it comes down to your personal feelings about debt and risks and what you're willing to do.
I want to pick up on this notion that people are feeling a little better about the economy. Can you talk about what you are seeing and hearing from your blog readers in terms of where they think we are at this point? Jim, any thoughts on that?
I think in the last few months, we've gone from, my readers anyway, have gone from the feeling that they're lost in the woods to they can sort of see the edge. Because a few months ago, everyone was asking, where should I invest to be safe? They want to learn about certificates of deposits. They want to learn about maybe municipal bonds. And now there's a little bit of a departure away from that. And part of it's because the stock market has performed quite well in the last few months. So there's a sense that we're not out of the woods, but we're no longer lost fumbling around trying to figure out where to go.
Do you think that we will all learn long-term lessons from this, or will our short-term memories kick in?
I want to believe we'll learn long-term lessons. I think that a lot of my friends, they've come to realize that things like debt, they control where you go into the future. And I think more people are going to be trying to avoid it as much as possible.
Lene, how are you feeling about the economy? Are you buying into this notion that we're out of the woods?
I think it depends on how much we've learned from what we've gone through in the last year. I think for a long time, we were all living above our means. I know I did that for a long time, and that created this situation, big companies trying to live beyond their means. It all came crashing down. So I think a lot of it depends on how much we've learned and how much we're going to change as a result of all the things that have happened over the last year.
Do you think we will change?
I don't know. I think that remains to be seen.
Steve, what about you? If we didn't learn from this crisis, what do you think it would take?
Well, I'm not sure spending habits were permanently altered by the Great Depression either. So I think human nature is to be optimistic and to probably spend beyond your means, because it's hard for people to think that they're ever going to hit a point of crisis. It's the same reason why people don't live healthy lifestyles, because, you know, it's hard to imagine your own mortality, and it's hard to imagine financial emergencies.
Well, Steve and Lene and Jim, as always, so nice to have you on the program, and keep up the good work on your blogs.
Thanks, Tess.
Thanks, Tess.
Thanks again, Tess.
And once again, Steve blogs at BripBlap.com, and Lene is at BeingFrugal.net. We'll have links to all of their websites on ours. It's marketplace.org. And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. It's time for Getting Personal, the part of the show where we take on your questions. And here with us once again is our own economics editor, Chris Farrell. And Chris, let's go right to the phones. We have Erin on the line, and she is in Brooklyn, New York. Hi, Erin.
Hi.
What's your question today?
Well, my husband and I are relocating across the country, and we've been looking at rentals in our new community. And one thing we've been noticing is on Craigslist and some of the kind of online boards for rentals, we've been seeing some listings that are described as possible rent-to-own situations.
Hmm.
But when we kind of look into that a little bit further, we've found not a lot of clarity on the part of the potential renters about what that really means and what the terms would be.
Well, Chris, I've heard of this with furniture, rent-to-own furniture. How does it work with a home?
Well, Tess, there is a side of the rent-to-own business which is associated with predatory lending. And what Aaron's talking about is a different part of the market. And rent-to-own typically expands when the real estate market's in trouble, it's hard to find buyers, sellers decide, okay, maybe I can find myself a buyer 2 or 3 years down the road by doing a rent-to-own agreement. And by the way, Erin, you're right. There are all kinds of different deals out there. The market is confusing. Typically what you do, you put your down payment and you're going to pay a rent premium. And over a period of 1 to 3 years, 1 to 4 years, if you end up buying the property, that rent premium and the deposit can go toward the down payment.
Chris, what do you mean by a rent premium? Is that basically over and above the normal rent that they would charge?
That's right. So let's say they found a place for $1,000.
Mm-hmm.
So you might be paying $1,100 instead. And then there are two major types. There's a lease option and there's a lease purchase. And these actually are big distinctions. A lease option says that, in 12 to 36 months, you know, you get to save money, improve your credit score, and you have the option in 12 to 36 months to purchase this property, typically at a set price, okay? But if you don't want to, you know, you lose the price of the option, which is that extra premium you've been paying, but you're not locked in.
Mm.
There's also what's called a lease purchase, which frankly I think is a big mistake, but there is such a thing as a lease purchase where you agree to buy the house and they agree to sell it to you after a set period of time, and you get 2 to 3 years to build up, again, your savings, your credit score. And it's a little more difficult if you decide this isn't the house or the condo that you want, as you can imagine.
So when do you set the price? That's the key question. Now or in 2 years?
Now. Right now.
Uh-huh.
Typically, you set the price now. Here's the main thing. Under certain circumstances, it can be a very smart move, but you're moving. So you're moving from Brooklyn. Now, I bet in Brooklyn, you could probably find a rent to own that you might like. You probably know the neighborhood. Boy, I could live in this place. That'd be fine. I could easily do a rent to own. Now you're moving to a new city where you don't really know the neighborhoods. What about the commute? It's all going to be very unfamiliar. Are you really going to want to lock yourself in and pay a premium? Because my guess is in 2 or 3 years, you're going to change your mind.
Some of the people seem kind of informal about how you do it. Well, we can talk about it in a year when your lease is up.
Why do you want to get involved in that kind of a situation?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure you want to be informal about buying a home.
You don't want to be. But for anybody who's thinking about rent-to-own, and not just you, Aaron, but anybody who's thinking about it, because it's all around the country and there are a lot of rent-to-own on Craigslist, there's one thing that's really important. You need a lawyer.
Okay.
All right? This is a very complicated contract. And you need a lawyer that actually really understands this contract. I was looking at one contract. It's a perfectly legitimate developer. So this is not saying illegitimate. It was in San Francisco. Big condo development. And I'm sure you've seen them all over the place where condo developments, you can't sell them. So they're for rent. And they're doing rent to own. And it sounds pretty attractive. But then you look at the fine print. We reserve the right to change the terms of the contract at any time.
Oh, that's not good.
So it sounds like we're kind of urging you to rent at this point, right, Chris?
It sounds that way. It's probably a wiser choice. It's tempting. It's a tempting idea, I think, especially since down payments have to be so high now.
Right.
But I hear your advice. Thank you.
And again, I don't want to say it's always a mistake. You should never do it. My job here is to lay out the risk for you. And mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of risk, particularly when you're moving 3,000 miles across the country.
Got it. All right.
All right. Well, good luck with the move, Aaron.
Thanks very much.
Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
All right, Chris, let's reach into the email bag. And Jurgen wrote in from Minnetonka, Minnesota, your neck of the woods. And he heard about the credit card reform bill on our show. And we had mentioned that one of the features is that companies cannot charge more for phone payments. So he's wondering, does this also apply to other forms of loans like mortgages and car notes?
The simple answer is no. The credit card reform bill, it dealt with credit cards. And it dealt with abuses in credit cards. So it didn't deal with your mortgage. It didn't deal with your auto loan or any of the other loans that you might have where you have to make a payment over the phone or online. And there might be a charge there depending on your bank or the institution you're working with.
All right. Short and sweet. If you're weighing some options and want us to help you run the numbers, we are happy to do so. Give us a call at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. You can also write to us. Go to marketplace.org and find the Getting Personal link. And we'll be back with more Getting Personal later in the show. Did your mortgage interest rate jump too high and the value of your home is too low to refinance? Well, you qualify for some big-time help from the government, unless you don't.
I can hear about it all the time, and I can go, that's me, that's me, that's me, and there's nothing I can do about it.
Coming up, we'll measure the progress of the mortgage fix. And make sure to get your fix of Marketplace Money every week. If you're, say, waiting in line at the bank when we're on the radio, you can catch us later with our podcast. Subscribe at marketplace.org, and you will have money directly deposited into your computer. Marketplace Money, that is, from American Public Media.
Oh,
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. For those of you keeping track, we are now on at least the third iteration of foreclosure prevention programs from Uncle Sam. First, the Bush administration had Hope Now, then Project Lifeline. And in March, the Obama administration announced the Making Home Affordable program. Yet, the Center for Responsible Lending reports that so far this year, it's tallied 1 million foreclosures. Tamara Keith looked into why homeowners are having such a tough time grabbing onto those life preservers.
Typically, to refinance your mortgage, you need to have 20% equity in your home. But with home values in the basement, a lot of people owe more than their home is worth. Or like Bob Lawrence, they owe pretty much exactly what it's worth.
We couldn't qualify for a $400,000 mortgage because the house is depreciated so much.
Lawrence and his wife bought their house 9 years ago. Then when the housing market got hot, they did what a lot of people did. They took money out of the house to make improvements. Now instead of owing $200,000, they owe $400,000. The house has vaulted ceilings, big windows, and a deck that hangs out over the Alafaya River near Tampa Bay, Florida.
We're at the widest part of the river, so it's really a very nice place to live.
Lawrence is recently retired, and with the stock market down, their income was down a bit too. When interest rates dropped last fall, he called his mortgage broker, looking to refinance and lower his monthly payment. But he got bad news. Home prices had fallen so much that the equity he thought he had was gone.
He said, we're not even going to send the appraiser out there. It'd be a waste of time. There was nothing we could do, but we were in shock.
But then the Making Home Affordable program came along. Under the program, people can borrow up to 105% of the value of their house, as long as they have good credit and a solid payment history. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the government-backed mortgage giants, have temporarily changed their lending standards to guarantee those refinanced mortgages. Lawrence's refinance just went through, and the lower interest payments are going to save close to $5,000 a year.
Well, it certainly pays some of the bills. You know? I mean, that's fundamentally why we did that.
According to data from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, so far nearly 25,000 mortgages have been refinanced through the program. For some, it's a chance to save a couple hundred dollars a month. For others, it's the best way out of a problematic loan, like one of those adjustable-rate mortgages pushing so many people to the brink. But many people don't qualify. In many areas, home values have just dropped too far. For Craig Freer in Arlington, Virginia, it was something else. His loan is owned by a private investor. Only loans owned by Fannie and Freddie qualify.
I had no control over that. And if my loan was owned by Fannie or Freddie, I feel like I would immediately qualify for this act. But because I don't have a loan through them, I can hear about it all the time and I can go, that's me, that's me, that's me. And there's nothing I can do about it.
Let's go up. Come on. You can do it. Let's go.
Freer is a government contractor in his late 20s. He bought this condo, his first home, back in 2006 near the height of the market. He didn't have the money for a down payment, but at the time he didn't need it. He took out two loans, one for 80%, one for 20%, and he made sure he would be able to afford the payments. Freer was counting on home prices to keep going up so he could refinance into one conventional mortgage. But at this point, he only has a few thousand dollars of equity, and that isn't enough.
I just want my loan combined at the current rate, and the fact that there's not a single bank who's willing to take my check every month baffles me.
He says one bank told him they'd be happy to refinance his mortgage if he could come to the table with $45,000.
So essentially, I log into the Fannie Mae website.
Craig Strent is a mortgage broker at Apex Home Loans in Bethesda, Maryland. And he's been helping a lot of clients lately figure out who owns their loans.
Ask you a couple pieces of information, putting in your street address and the city and state that you live in.
Both Fannie and Freddie now have these simple online forms. But it turns out just qualifying may not be the only issue. Strent pulls out a chart.
This is the sound of me sifting through lender rate sheets.
And those lender rate sheets determine how your interest rate is calculated. The federal program doesn't get you a discount. As with any mortgage, several variables can cost you. If your credit score is less than stellar, if you own a condo instead of a house, or if you don't have much equity. And Strent says these interest rate penalties add up.
Oftentimes, by the time you make those adjustments to the rate, the benefits of doing the refinance comparative to the cost don't necessarily always make sense.
Add to this the fact that interest rates are rising and a making home affordable refinance is going to pencil out for fewer and fewer people. In Washington, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com. And by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding, online at finrafoundation.org.
We are back with more Getting Personal. Time for more questions with our economics editor, Chris Farrell. And Chris, let's go to Sean. He is on the phone with us from Atlanta, Georgia. Hi, Sean.
How are you doing?
All right. Well, what's your question for Chris today?
Okay. I'm 40 years old and I'm a software developer. And I've been hearing all of what's going on with health insurance on the news lately. And I was kind of, you know, thinking about the future and wondering, what are my options when I retire? So I didn't really know if my health insurance, whether I'd be able to keep it after I retired. So I talked to my HR person, and apparently I cannot. So my first question, I guess, is, you know, is that fairly common among companies? And my second question, I guess, is I think I'd rather not depend on Medicare. So, you know, how can I plan for the eventuality of when I retire?
Chris, I have a feeling that you're going to point out here that employer-sponsored health care and retirement has gone the way of the pension.
It absolutely has. It's just simply too expensive. So that's really not something anybody should be counting on at all.
Okay.
So what can he do?
There are two things I want to get across. First is the importance of investing in your own health. I mean, that sounds silly, but, you know, exercising, eating right, you know, that's as important as saving in a 401k or a 403b when we think about preparing for our retirement. The second thing is you're 40, right?
Yes.
All right. So in 25 years, when you're thinking about retirement, the healthcare system is going to have changed a lot. Whether Medicare will be there in 25 years or whether we'll roll Medicare into some overall universal healthcare plan, I don't really know. I mean, I think that's the way we should go. But whether we do or not, who has a clue? You know, you follow the basics of personal finance, savings, and invest in your health. And that's what you can do at this point.
Well, thanks a lot.
All right. Thanks for the call. And next, we have an email from Wendy in Madison, Connecticut. And Chris, she's thinking of switching from a traditional individual health care plan to an HSA. She says she is the perfect candidate, relatively young, healthy, but she's wondering what kind of downsides there might be with an HSA.
Okay, so this is what more and more people are facing this as employees when they get the package from their employer and they said you want to be in sort of a traditional plan, perhaps a health maintenance organization, HMO, and then what's called a PPO, preferred provider organization, which is sort of the classic healthcare plan, and then the health savings account, which is the newfangled creature out there. And typically what the employer will do is they will help fund your health savings account. So they'll put some money in there, $500, $1,000, $2,000. And that's one of the attractions of a health savings account is that you own that.
Mm-hmm.
That's yours. You can withdraw the money tax-free to pay for those qualified medical expenses. And then you have to just look at, okay, do you take any medications? What about your doctors? Are you going to get to use the doctors that you want to use? So you just go through all those classic things. Any medical issues going to come up? I mean, of course, we're always, there's always uncertainty about that. But, you know, you can look ahead and have sort of an idea of some things that may be coming along. And you sort of go through and you look at the different plans. Well, how do they deal with pregnancy? How do they deal with an emergency? And just run through and see where you come out ahead.
And she also had a question about where that money is sitting. If it's in a bank, she doesn't know that she can trust it to be there in the future. Is there any government protection for money in an HSA?
With an HSA, when it's in a bank, it's an FDIC-insured account.
Okay.
Now, most health savings accounts also offer the option of investing in mutual funds.
Mm-hmm.
That is not FDIC insured. One other thing just to toss in there for everyone who's sort of facing the situation, there's a very good website, planforyourhealth.com, and it's a joint venture between Aetna and the Financial Planning Association. And so you can really get a lot of good information about how to evaluate the different plans and help her and anybody else think through this choice.
Well, actually, that was another question that we got from Jeremy in Santa Cruz, California. He is wondering, what is the best way to shop around for an HSA?
Two sources that I like. One is ehealthinsurance.com. That's one place to go shopping.
And we'll have a link to that on our website.
And hsainsider.com. These are two, you know, seem perfectly reasonable options for doing some comparison shopping online.
Okay. Well, you know, these HSA accounts can be really hard to figure out after you've signed up for them and started using the account. In fact, we've had people around our office wondering about documents that they get related to their HSA accounts. You know, are they statements? Are they investment documents? It's really hard to tell sometimes.
Yes, and you're to be the educated consumer, right?
Right, exactly, supposedly. So we're wondering if anyone else out there has had trouble deciphering their HSA. We'd like you to let us know. Go to marketplace.org and find our question this week about health savings accounts. Unfortunately, that's all the time we've got for questions, but we can take more anytime at our phone number. It's 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or write us an email. You'll find the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org, as well as Chris's blog, where he's got a lot more answers for everybody. Chris, thanks so much for the great advice.
It was fun. Thanks, Tess.
You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Author Alain de Botton likes to muse on the big topics in life. He's written sweeping tomes on love and happiness and travel, and now work. His latest book is The Pleasures and Sorrows of Work, and in it he explores why we love or hate what we do all day long. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So, you know, there have been journalists who've gone behind the scenes in all kinds of different industries, philosophers who've pondered work, but your book is not quite either of those things. What did you set out to do here?
Well, it's a mixture of kind of philosophical journalism in the sense that I head out into the workplace, but rather than simply reporting on what I find there, I drive into the material certain really big questions that we all tend to ask ourselves of work, like where's all this headed, what's the meaning of it, what's the purpose, what are its upsides and its downsides. And the book has a very simple structure. It's made up of 10 chapters, each of which looks at a particular occupation, like logistics, power transmission, accountancy, rocket science, biscuit manufacture, the sort of jobs that people have in the modern economy.
I want to pick up on something you said, which is that this is the exploration of what is the meaning of work, what are its ups and downs. And, you know, frankly, those are the questions that we all ask about life in general. What does that tell us about how much work has become our lives?
Well, it's true that for most of recorded human history, work was something that people did, but it wasn't where they expected to put their center of meaning and their hope for a good life. But ever since about the middle of the 18th century, in the UK and the US, we've moved towards a different system that really identifies work with the meaning of life. So you work for money, sure, but you work for deeper reasons, for identity, for self-fulfillment, for growth. Not having a job, not being in employment is a kind of shameful condition because you're lacking not only money but also an identity. If you go to a party and someone says, well, what do? You won't have an answer.
And I guess with so many people losing their jobs these days, how does that affect your relationship with work in general? Not just the place where you were laid off from, but the whole notion of work and a career.
Well, I think it all depends on how much you believe that the world is a meritocracy. I.e. a society where literally, if you're good, good things happen to you and you get to the top. And if you're bad, well, you might get to the bottom and you might be fired, etc. The world simply doesn't work that way. Luck, accident, biology, weather, chance, all these things are playing a huge part. I prefer to take my cue from religion. I'm a secular man, but there's a lovely bit in St. Augustine where he says somewhere that it is a sin, very strong word, a sin, to judge anybody by their post. We would mean by that by their job. The terrible thing about unemployment for many people is they feel horrendously judged. You know how all of us think there's something horrible and unacceptable about us? When we're unemployed, we think, somebody's discovered that horrible and unacceptable part. And my advice to anybody who's lost their job is, genuinely, it is not your fault. You know, we are not the center of everything that happens to us.
In one chapter, you write about cookie production, or biscuits, as you call them in England. And in that chapter, you talk about job titles and how specific our jobs are now. And on page 80, I'm wondering if maybe you could read from the paragraph at the bottom of that page.
Yeah. It's surely significant that the adults who feature in children's books are rarely, if ever, regional sales manager or building services engineers. They are shopkeepers, builders, cooks, or farmers, people whose labour can easily be linked to the visible betterment of human life.
So why do you think that is?
Well, we keep many things hidden from children, and I think one of the things we keep hidden from children is just how overcomplicated the world economy has become. Very few of us have these boldly defined jobs left anymore. Most of us are doing a tiny bit of a tiny bit of a tiny bit of a vast project. And I think that's a dispiriting thing to say to a four-year-old. I've not yet broken this dark truth to my four-year-old.
So what do you tell him your job title is?
Well, I say that I'm a writer, and he has a lot of conversations about, have I not thought about doing something more interesting?
Perhaps being a train conductor?
Yes, of course, or an astronaut. You can't understand that.
I want to ask you about your work. You are certainly not a cog in any sort of wheel. You are a writer. Mm. You know, you get to design your own work day. Have you ever had an experience of working in an office? And if so, did you like it?
I have. I've worked in a lot of journalists' offices and a lot of television production offices, but what I haven't had is a sense of myself as an office worker for life, you know, with a pension scheme at the end and health insurance, etc. I've never felt owned by one large organization. I miss it. I sometimes have nostalgia and fantasies about what it would be like.
I could tell you all about it.
Well, you know, it's pretty scary in a way, being a freelancer. On a good day, it feels tremendously free. You feel like you really are designing your own life and succeeding at it. On a bad day, you think you're headed for disaster with no safety net. It's definitely a riskier sort of thing. But I think the pleasures and sorrows of work as a writer are quite similar to the pleasures and sorrows of a brain surgeon or somebody in a, you know, data office. You know, many of the same themes are there. It's, do you feel in control of the work you're doing? Do you feel it's making a difference? Do you feel it's being appreciated? All of these things, you know, work right across the board, whatever work it happens to be that you're doing.
Alain de Botton is the author of The Pleasures and Sorrows of Work. It's certainly been a pleasure having you as part of my work today. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Pleasures, sorrows, we'd love to hear your thoughts about work. Write to us at marketplace.org. And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, the foreclosure crisis is making its way up the income ladder to homeowners with jumbo loans. Some buyers smell opportunity.
It sold in 2006 for $800,000. The asking price was $595,000.
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman and Eve Trobe. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Viglund. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something from Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com.
American Public Media.